there's no question in my mind that Israel's committed human rights violations, and to exempt Israel from any sort of scrutiny is a travesty of justice.
The ICC has less to worry about, at least for now. The letter reads that the purpose of the court is well established and recognized, that accountability for serious rights violations by all sides through conflict is essential for achieving sustainable and lasting peace. The key question is, will the ICC's findings be grounds for holding anyone accountable for prosecution if guilty of war crimes and human rights violations?
Israel's afraid that there will be international warrants issued for various Israeli officials who participated in the planning and directing the attack on Gaza. Gaza is the most densely populated place on the planet. And, you know, if you look at the pictures, you know, whole families were targeted and killed. And it's grossly disproportionate in terms of what the Palestinians were doing. And Israel's attack on Palestinians in Jerusalem was the initial cause of that, which is also very troubling.
The former Danish foreign minister and former president of the UN General Assembly have said a rules-based global order is predicated upon the idea that violations of international law must be met with consequences. The United States and, more importantly, Israel in this case, are not members of the ICC, so they do not fall under the ICC's jurisdiction. But the ICC, as an international criminal court, can pursue the rule of law, in this case, violations of human rights in occupied Palestine. The investigation, in many cases, should be an open and shut case, since there are obvious Israeli violations that have taken place over the decades. So many violations that in a recent report, Human Rights Watch called Israel an apartheid regime. This was quite significant since for the first time ever, Human Rights Watch made the informed and evidence-based assessment that the actions of the Israeli regime with regards to its treatment of the Palestinian people has crossed the threshold qualifying it as apartheid.
I certainly concur with Human Rights Watch's assessment. Several Israeli human rights organizations, B'Tselem, have said the same thing. And if you look at the evidence, there is, it's clear that, much of the Israeli policy is punitive. In fact, current Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is quoted, saying that how he was going to punish the Palestinians and how they would, squeeze them and actually instigate problems for them so they could reach out and attack the Palestinian population.
Israel finds itself in a precarious state. With no functioning system of governance and isolation on the international stage, it is a very fragile entity. To add to Israel's worry, it's been revealed that the leaders of the resistance groups Hamas and Hezbollah met last year to discuss plans for the liberation of Palestine from the Israeli occupation. The recent blow dealt to Israel during the 11-day Gaza war was also part of the liberation plan. The Palestinian resistance adopted tactics used by Hezbollah during the 2006 war by setting up mock rocket launch sites to deceive the Israeli Air Force. This only means that the Israeli regime's days of violating the Palestinian rights are numbered. Forced evictions, detainment without charge, freedom of movement, home demolitions, and the killing of Palestinians are illegal actions that happen almost on a daily basis. Plus, the three Gaza wars were proof of Israel's disproportionate killing of Palestinians. The question now remains whether a judicial body can prosecute Israel and its officials into obvious cases of war crimes, regardless of the U.S. obstruction of justice in favor of Israel.
When you have former prime ministers, ministers in governments, and high-ranking officials calling for the International Criminal Court to exercise its rights and to investigate war crimes, this is an opportunity to review Israel's actions and, of course, hold them accountable. And there could be warrants issued by the International Criminal Court.
The EU is Israel's biggest trading partner. Of these high-ranking EU officials who really want justice to prevail, they can economically sanction Israel, as called by the BDS movement, boycott, divestment, and sanctions, if Israel does not cooperate with the investigation. Israel faces ever-growing isolation in the international arena and risks continuing with its violations.
Come Commodities traders in the United States came across something surprising last week when the U.S. Energy Information Agency released its new figures. The EIA figures included Iranian crude oil for the first time in decades. The government statistics and court documents show the U.S. has sold about 2 million barrels of Iranian crude after seizing an oil tanker off the coasts of the United Arab Emirates. American authorities say they brought the Liberian-flagged tanker Achilles to Houston, Texas in March. It was ordered to discharge its cargo at the port of Galveston. The crude from the oil vessel, which the U.S. says was transporting Iranian oil, was then sold for $110 million. American officials say the tanker was covertly transporting the cargo to China in violation of U.S. sanctions against Iran over its nuclear program. U.S. court documents also allege the vessel was subject to forfeiture under American anti-terrorism statutes. Some observers have described the seizure as illegal under international law and argue that it amounts to piracy.
I mean, it's piracy, it's theft. It's amazing that the United States can appropriate to itself the right to do such things. This exceeds even, you know, the Roman Empire. And the Roman Empire was a cruel empire within its boundaries, but it couldn't go outside of its boundaries and tell the rest of the world what to do.
Anti-Iran hawk former U.S. President Donald Trump has been gone for months now. But the United States has kept up its anti-Iran policies under Democratic President Joe Biden. The recent seizure of the oil tanker was a stark reminder that America's anti-Iran measures are not ending. Many such measures were reimposed by former U.S. President Donald Trump, who abandoned the hard-earned 2015 Iran nuclear deal. His successor, Joe Biden, says sanctions are not exactly his favorite, but the anti-Iran measures are being fully enforced under his watch. The Islamic Republic's oil shipping and banking are among the sectors targeted by America's unilateral sanctions. Iran has repeatedly described America's measures as economic war. The American sanction mechanism has made it extremely difficult for Iran to purchase some essential goods like medicines. The American president promised a shift in U.S. policy on Iran, but he has so far failed to fulfill his pledge to change course.
As far as its foreign policy goes, this is truly the neocon foreign policy. These are the actors from the Obama administration, people who had key roles when Hillary Clinton was the Secretary of State, like Campbell and Sullivan, people who are now in these critical positions inside the administration, and Samantha Power at AID, and so on and so forth, who really were able to impose the most terrible sanctions on Iran.
The United States and Iran say they are willing to return to the 2015 nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Iran and the remaining parties to the deal, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany, have held several rounds of talks in Vienna aimed at restoring the half-dead nuclear deal. Diplomats from the United States have been present in Vienna and talking with their P4+1 counterparts. There have been some signs of progress in Vienna, raising hopes for a revival of the international nuclear agreement. But critics believe that even if the U.S. returns to the deal, past experience shows that there is no guarantee that the U.S. will honor its commitments in the future.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Plastics are manufactured and often incinerated in the U.S. communities where poor people and people of color are rarely consulted or alerted to the risks. Studies have shown how rampant the plastic crisis is, finding microplastics in deep sea animals, in fish, in bodies, and even in rain. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Yvette Arellano, researcher. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Latinx and Low-Income Communities Are Paying Human Costs of Plastic Pollution. Stay tuned for more. Plastics are manufactured and often incinerated in the U.S. communities where poor people and people of color are rarely consulted or alerted to the risks. These communities are living this pollution every day and understand the connections between air, water, land, ocean, and human health in very personal and concrete ways. The Clean Air Task Force estimates that 1.8 million Latinx people in the U.S. live within half a mile of an oil and gas facility, increasing odds of preterm birth and respiratory illness. The production of plastic feedstocks and the raw fossil fuels used to make most plastics affect communities immune, reproductive, developmental, and respiratory systems starting 8 outside factory fence lines. It is no surprise that the communities have been hit the hardest by the COVID-19 as the immune systems are already compromised. Plastic pollution violates their human rights to breathe without fear. Plastic also fuels the climate crisis and contributes to climate change at every step of its life cycle, from extraction to refinement, manufacture, transportation, disposal, and waste. If plastic production and use grow as currently planned, emissions from plastic production could reach 1.34 gigatons per year by 2030, equivalent to the emissions released by more than 295 new 500-megawatt coal-fired power plants. 99% of plastic is derived from fossil fuels, and the direct impact its production has in the U.S. communities is a real global crisis. Studies have shown how rampant the plastic crisis is, finding microplastics in deep-sea animals, in fish, in bodies, and even in rain. We'll be right back.
States, the federal government, and consumers need to hold companies accountable by incentivizing them to, in a way, demanding that they use less packaging, consider reusable or refillable options, and take the plastic life cycle into account in purchasing. Initiatives that appear across the state and federal efforts include incentivizing shower gel manufacturers to offer refills or reusable options, and to manage any waste they produce without a goal of recycling at least 65% by 2027. Starting as early as 2023, requiring hotels and motels to have bulk stations for shampoo and conditioner instead of the mini shampoo, soap, and lotion containers, and requiring restaurants and food vendors to only give out compostable utensils and plastic straws upon request. The U.S. plastic industry lobby, backed by the U.S. fossil fuels industry, is already pushing back on these state and national efforts. The poor communities of the U.S. need to hold accountable those who profit the most from pollution, and these bills across the U.S. and in Washington, D.C. are a great start. The truth is that plastic isn't cheap. Its cost is externalized to those at the fence lines of extraction, production, and waste. It's time to address the plastic pollution crisis at the national level. Thousands of green Latinos and members of the global Break Free from Plastics movement are calling on Congress to break society's addiction to plastic. U.S. Latinx communities have long-standing practices that demonstrate to society ways to live without plastics. They must strive to end the harm that plastics are having on health, the lives, and climate and culture, and the planet Earth totally.
On June 3, 1989, Ayatollah Sayyid Ruhollah Mousavi Khomeini, the leader of the Islamic Revolution of Iran, passed away at the age of 89. Millions of Iranians flocked to the streets of Tehran mourning the death of the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, especially from the Muslim world, to pay tribute to a man whose life set an example for anyone thirsty for liberation, justice, and humanity. More than three decades after his death, Ayatollah Khomeini's memory lives on, and his ideas still inspire freedom seekers of the world. Core of Imam Khomeini's ideas lies the overarching concept of resistance. Resistance against any encroaching entity that targets the heart of a nation, its history, identity, and sovereignty. Heroic resistance against the colonial powers of the time. The Islamic Revolution of Iran in 1979 was the epitome of an active, effective resistance against the imperialism of the United States and a revolt against its puppet ruler in the country.
The Shah of Iran used to call himself the King of Kings. Anyway, in order not to go too deep into history, Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi ruled Iran, and at the beginning of the 1960s, of course, he was a dictator, an oppressive ruler. There was no freedom, there was no will of the people, there was no priority given to the concerns of the people domestically, and as much as possible, he tried to keep the people away from their culture and their religion and their Islam and their sanctities and their history and their heritage. And also, he made it as a member of the American-led Axis.
In the absence of such resistance, nations are first robbed of their natural resources and then become big marketplaces for Western consumer goods. The oil-rich Saudi kingdom is a case in point, a country humiliated over and over again by the Americans, despite the billions of dollars it gives to Washington in the form of arms deals, but in fact, it is the money Riyadh gives as a bribe. Imam Khomeini called on all Muslims across the world to rediscover their Islamic identity, regain their confidence and resist against the hegemony of foreign powers, with the ultimate goal of liberation from the yoke of colonialism in any shape or form. It is not an exaggeration to say that it is the Imam's discourse of resistance that has foiled many imperialistic plots by the world powers in Western Asia, if not in other places around the world. Ayatollah Khomeini believed Muslims the world over would be able to ease their plight through unity and solidarity. As a Muslim scholar, he called on all Muslim nations to gain intellectual independence from the West and revive and repeat their glorious past. Imam Khomeini drew attention to self-sufficiency and self-reliance as a prerequisite to the real development of nations. The resistance movement Imam Khomeini initiated was against the tyranny and injustice Iranians faced under the rule of Mohammad Reza Shah. The movement, however, evolved into the biggest revolution in the final decades of the 20th century and inspired, in the coming decades, many other countries in the Muslim world to stand up against their tyrannical rulers. Massive protests in 2011, which rocked the Arab world, could be regarded as the continuation of the movement led by Ayatollah Khomeini, which resulted in the fall of the Shah of Iran. At the same time, Ayatollah Khomeini attached great importance to the issue of Palestine. To him, active resistance on behalf of the Muslim world could show its peak in fighting against the Israeli regime, which he likened to a cancerous tumor, and considered the occupation of Palestine as a broader occupation planned for the rest of the Arab world. He said, "Everyone should realize that the goals pursued by superpowers by creating Israel did not end in the occupation of Palestine. They plan, heaven forbid, to extend the fate of Palestine to all Arab countries." The fact is, Ayatollah Khomeini raised the alarm as far as the 1960s, almost 15 years after the creation of the Israeli regime, when the threat of Israel as a regime that could endanger peace and security in the region was comprehended neither regionally nor globally. After the victory of the Islamic Revolution, the Imam continued to address the issue of Palestine as the main issue in the Muslim world, not an issue having to do with the Arabs alone. Even today, the major pro-Palestinian resistance movements and organizations, such as Hezbollah and Hamas, that stand against the occupying regime of Israel, are all the legacy of Imam Khomeini's support for the oppressed people of Palestine. It is hard to imagine how the Middle East would look like without a resistance hero like Ayatollah Khomeini.
IB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
Listeners, we're with you with another episode of this series. Continuing with discussion of Imam Khomeini's ethical virtues, you will hear more on his high carefulness about achieving spirituality and expurgation of the soul. Please stay with us. According to Islamic culture, the remembrance of death is one of the means to gain spirituality and to purify your soul. Remembrance of death revives the heart and reminds the individual that the world is transient. Hence, he should make the best use of the time on this world for self-building. In Islamic narrations, we read, "Increase the remembrance of death, because no servant of God has increased the remembrance of death except God has revived his heart and made death easy for him." The 10th infallible successor of the Prophet of Islam, Imam Ali al-Naqi al-Hadi, peace be upon him, says, "Remember the time when you are lying in deathbed in your family. While no physician can prevent your death, nor any friend can benefit you." One of the recommendations of Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, for young students of seminaries was to remember death. He used to tell the students to think that every moment of man's life is a step towards death and grave. Hujjatul Islam Hamid Rouhani says, Imam Khomeini said in his first speech after arriving in Najaf in Iraq, "Think right from now. Think right from your youth. Every step that you take is towards grave. Every minute that passes in your life, you're getting a little closer to the grave and the place in which you'll be interrogated. What matters is approaching death, and no one has given you a document that you will live for 120 years. Man may die at the age of 25. God forbid he may die just right now. There is no document. You should take heed and expurgate your soul." Thank you. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, used to emphasize on purification of the soul or expurgation of the soul and the self, just as the individual acquires knowledge or even more than that. According to Quranic teachings, he believed that the prerequisite for real benefiting of knowledge is to engage in self-expurgation. Later, Ayatollah Muhammad Reza Tavassuli recounts an anecdote in this regard. He says, Imam Khomeini used to advise young students at classes, saying, expurgate yourselves. Moral expurgation is before acquisition of knowledge, and if man wants to benefit from his knowledge, he should first be expurgated. Dear listeners, Imam Khomeini would advise young students to take two steps in self-expurgation for every step in acquiring knowledge. Ayatollah Hassan Qadiri says, the Imam not only himself was expurgated, but also he always tried to train students with expurgation. And he used to advise them from time to time, and that through his special method of sincerity and love. Years later, we still recall his advice. He used to say that for every step in knowledge, two steps should be taken in expurgation of the soul. He said, all leaders of false religions have been scholars, but they have not expurgated their souls. Dear friends, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, used to tell young students to appreciate their youth for worship and attaining good virtues, so that they get accustomed to those virtues. Late Ayatollah Abbas Ali Amid Zanjani related an account. One day, the Imam told the students, try not to let evil characteristics take root in you, because with the passage of time, these characteristics will be firm, and the person will reach the place that it would be impossible to get rid of these characteristics or bad habits. As long as you are young, try to get accustomed to worship. Ayatollah Sayyid Ja'far Karimi also has an anecdote with regards to Imam Khomeini. He says, Imam Khomeini perhaps would remind scores of times, do everything such as writing, studying, research, worship, attaining spiritual virtues in your youth, and make use of the circumstances. Although Imam Khomeini emphasized on worship for young students, he would warn against going to extremes. Martyr Ayatollah Fazlullah Mahallati says, Imam Khomeini would tell students, if the youth stick to recommended deeds, they would be distanced from obligatory deeds. He would even say, those who were too scared left the seminary due to such extremes. Too much worship is tiring for teenagers, of people of 15 or 16 years of age. Youth should enjoy legitimate entertainment, but shouldn't sin. He even said, they can wrestle, but not backbite. Ayatollah Ahmad Jannati says, once I asked Imam Khomeini to guide me on spiritual perfection. He said, strive in purity of action. Late Ayatollah Muhammad Mu'min also said, when I was in Najaf, I wrote a letter to the Imam and requested him to advise me, even if it is a general advice. He said, the best advice is the one that God has given in the Holy Quran. Say, I give you just a single advice, that you rise up for Allah's sake. The Imam considered remembrance of God as an important factor for inward building and attaining and preserving of light in the heart and the soul. Later Ayatollah Sayyid Hassan Badala also says, with regards to Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, I remember once the Imam said during his ethical classes in Qom, those who take steps in the way of self-building, sometimes there will be small holes of light for them. The more this hole is preserved, the more it will increase. After the class, I asked the Imam how to preserve this luminous state. He answered, that state should be kept through communication with God. and remembrance of God, and man should be in remembrance of God as much as he can.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on June 4, 2014, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of the demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini. The speech was delivered at Imam Khomeini's shrine.
In the face of all these invasions, and all these violent and unscrupulous hostilities, the Islamic Republic was not destroyed. It did not adopt a conservative outlook. It was not blackmailed by the West, and it made progress on a daily basis. This is what forms the essence of this curiosity. Despite the fact that the primary military, political, and economic powers of the world joined hands against a country and a government, and despite the fact that they made efforts for 35 years, Not only was this government not destroyed, but it also became stronger on a daily basis. This government was not blackmailed by them, and it did not pay any attention to them at all. The Islamic Republic showed its power and capability to survive in different arenas. Today, when they look at the Islamic Republic, they see that the second and third generations of the revolution in the country are several million students, several thousand knowledgeable clergy, several thousand researchers, several thousand university and seminary professors, thousands of scientific and intellectual personalities, some of whom are well known on an international level, and thousands of activists and producers and thousands of political, cultural and economic personalities. This is the reality about our today's society. Of science and technology, the Islamic Republic launches satellites into space despite all sanctions. It sends living creatures into space and it brings them back. It produces nuclear energy. It is ranked amongst the first 10 countries in the world in many new sciences. The centers in charge of releasing statistics have announced that the rate of scientific progress in the Islamic Republic is 13 times faster than the global average. It gives scientific and technological services to different countries. Despite unprecedented sanctions, it manages a 75 million strong country. It has the final word on regional policies. It shows resistance against the uprising Zionist regime, which is supported by global bullies, and it does this on its own. It does not compromise with oppressors, and it defends the oppressed. Any well-informed individual becomes curious to know what this organism and phenomenon is and how it benefits from all these innate capabilities and this potential to survive despite all the enmities.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
At a time when the greatest challenges to human lives and livelihoods stem from threats like pandemics and climate change, sustaining Pentagon spending at over $750 billion a year is both bad budgeting and bad security policy, the Center for International Policy's William Harting said. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Mark Perry, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Biden Budget Bakes in Billions for Nuclear Weapons. Stay tuned for more. Anticipating a significant shift in national priorities in the wake of the huge increase in defense expenditures during the last administration, to the tune of some $100 billion over 4 years, President Biden's fiscal year 2022 national defense budget is a major disappointment. The Biden administration has recently submitted its fiscal year 2022 budget request with a whopping $752.9 billion set aside for national defense, $715 billion of which is designated for the Pentagon. The proposed funding actually increases defense expenditures by some $11 billion from the Trump years. Congressman Mark Focan and Congresswoman Barbara Lee called the Biden defense budget a failure that doesn't reflect this country's actual needs. The joint Focan-Lee statement released recently slammed Biden's proposal, pointing out that the defense spending increase by itself is 1.5 times larger than the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's entire $8.7 billion budget. Defense hawks, on the other hand, were as outspoken in their criticism, arguing that the Biden defense budget does not account for inflation, which means that to keep pace, Pentagon spending should be ramped up to the tune of 3 to 5% annually. President Biden's defense budget request is wholly inadequate. It's nowhere near enough to give our service members the resources, equipment, and training they need. Senate Armed Services Committee Ranking Member Jim Inhofe and his House counterpart, Representative Mike Rogers, said in a statement, "It's disingenuous to call this request an increase because it doesn't even keep up with inflation. It's a cut," it added. Most disappointing for progressives is the Biden administration's apparent endorsement of the Trump administration's decision to spend big in modernizing America's nuclear forces, a decision that could cost the nation upwards of $1.5 trillion over the next 15 years and as much as $634 billion over the next 10 years, according to the Congressional Budget Office. Congressional progressives describe the amount as a wholly unnecessary and extravagant expenditure. As an example, the Biden budget reflects the White House decision to double the amount the nation will spend on developing and deploying the ground-based strategic deterrent to propose $2.6 billion from $1.4 billion. The monies do not include upgrades to launch facility locations and nuclear labs, which would cost tens of billions more. The GBSD is intended to replace the 50-year-old Minuteman III intercontinental ballistic missile, the ICBM. While the $2.6 billion figure might seem modest compared to the bulk of defense expenditures, the GBSD serves as a template for the nuclear modernization program, accounting for $27.7 billion in the Biden budget, while committing the United States to maintaining the nuclear triad, the three-legged mix of missile-launched, submarine-launched, and bomber-launched nuclear weapons. In total, an upgrade of the Minuteman III could cost awards of $264 billion over the period of its development and deployment. Then, too, in addition to the funding for the increasingly controversial GBSD, the Biden defense budget includes expenditures for a new Columbia-class submarine, further development and deployment of the B-21 bomber, and a long-range standoff weapon. In the weeks preceding then budget's release, congressional progressives and their allies among anti-nuke NGOs had been gearing up for a fight over nuclear modernization, arguing that land-based nuclear missiles pose the most destabilizing part of the U.S. arsenal, and that part of the triad that is most susceptible to an accidental launch. These advocates argue that Spending for the GBSD is unnecessary since the Minuteman III can be regularly upgraded over the next 10 years without adopting the budget-busting numbers proposed by the Trump administration. That thinking is in line with a series of options detailed in an intriguing study by the Congressional Budget Office that would cut back the number of delivery systems and nuclear warheads over a period of 10 years, saving tens of billions of dollars but without any erosion in nuclear deterrence. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren is one of those likely to lead the charge against the nuclear modernization program, particularly given her focus on it during the Senate's February confirmation hearings for Dr. Kathleen Hicks to be Deputy Secretary of Defense. I know that you believe in a safe and secure and reliable nuclear deterrent, but we are going to spend $44.5 billion on nuclear weapons this year, which is more than the entire budget for the State Department and Foreign Operations accounts, Warren said to Hicks back in February. Will you commit that your review will not be simply be a rubber stamp of our current nuclear strategy, but that you really will examine and re-question the core assumptions that underpin it? Hicks assured Warren that she would. Absolutely, Senator, she responded. Now, in the wake of President Biden's seeming endorsement of a large portion of the previous administration's nuclear modernization program, that reassurance is very much in doubt. Despite Defense Secretary Austin's public testimony recently before a Defense Appropriations Subcommittee hearing, that the Biden team will be conducting its own review in the months ahead. In all of this, there is a sense that both the White House and Pentagon are attempting to downplay just how similar the Biden administration's defense budget is to the most recent defense budget proposed by Donald Trump. It was a purposeful soft pedaling of the dollar amount for defense in comparison with other administration priorities and heavy-handed public statements that emphasize Biden's commitment to innovation, advanced capability enablers, and cutting-edge state-of-the-art technologies like microelectronics, artificial intelligence, hypersonics, machine learning, 5G networking. It was a purposeful, if transparent, sleight of hand, as the Biden team wasn't actually committed to buying weapons, but rather to a visionary and forward-leaning posture, as Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin described it. Few, it seems, were fooled. At a time when the greatest challenges to human lives and livelihoods stem from threats like pandemics and climate change, sustaining Pentagon spending at over three-quarters of $1 trillion a year is both bad budgeting and bad security policy, the Center for International Policy's William Harting said.
Around the world with reporters.
After the failure of Moscow talks, an Omani delegation along with the Yemeni negotiating delegation has arrived at Sana'a Airport as part of efforts to find a peaceful solution to the years-long war on Yemen. Mohammed Abdel Salam, who headed the Yemeni delegation at the talks, said the meeting was aimed at pushing up the humanitarian situation that has been deteriorating due to the all-out blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia.
That
Talks are held to discuss the overall situation in Yemen, including the peace talks and the humanitarian crisis in Yemen. Oman has always served as an arena for all Yemenis in political affairs, and today we are going to complete the efforts we made in Oman during the past months.
Observers say this move could make a difference in the political process, as Oman has always been beside Yemenis and realizes the circumstances of Yemen.
The Omani delegation is welcomed in our country because Oman has always been a good neighbor. We hope Oman could help us remove the current humanitarian crisis. We must have this point in mind that if the U.S. continues to link the humanitarian crisis in Yemen to the military realities on the ground, no progress would be made. Therefore, the humanitarian crisis in Yemen should be top on the agenda.
The latest round of negotiations in Oman's capital, Muscat, failed to find a solution to the world's worst humanitarian crisis in Yemen. According to the UN Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, the Saudi-led coalition war on Yemen has killed almost a quarter of a million Yemenis, caused outbreaks of disease, turned Yemen into the world's worst humanitarian crisis, and brought the poor Arab country to the verge of famine.
Yemenis are optimistic about the Omani delegation visit to their country, saying Oman is capable of achieving what the UN envoy has failed during the past years and putting an end to the suffering of the war-ravaged nation. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
As India continues to battle the deadly COVID-19 pandemic, the destitute Rohingya community fights it all alone. The community is not eligible to apply for vaccine since they are described as illegal immigrants. Rights activists say they are in desperate need of help as the virus has started raging across the camps.
First they started the deportation drive, then detention, and now the lockdowns. Why are all miseries for us? Why is the world silent? Don't we have the right to live? We have no work due to lockdowns, and now this virus is frightening us since we can't get access to any healthcare services here.
The COVID-19 pandemic has brought more miseries to the community, since most of them used to work in the unorganized sector. Now, due to lockdowns, most of them have lost their jobs, forcing them to live on charity, while hunger and poverty looms over the community. The refugee camps are cramped, and the spread of virus is inevitable, they say, since their makeshift shanties lean on each other with no sanitation, food support, or health care, since they are not included in the government's support programs. Most of them work as daily wage workers or scrap collectors to make a living, but the government restrictions and lockdown has left many out of work.
Some locals and NGOs are helping us with food and other essentials in these dire times. We, however, urge the UN Refugee Agency to play their part. We don't need just guidelines. We need access to vaccination.
Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh and other countries, including India, escaping genocide in their country. Estimates suggest some 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living across different Indian states.
In recent weeks, many of these refugees, including children, had developed COVID-like symptoms. But due to lack of testing facilities and shortage of vaccine, they're on their own. Most of them have resorted to home remedies and self-quarantine. Many, however, fear if they don't get access to medicine and vaccine, a humanitarian disaster awaits their community. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.